Hello there, it's Jim here with another caper. This is number 29, and it's a further investigation into the profound influences that others can have on our lives, particularly when it relates to our boating interest. Our last two capers examine what childhood influences might have. But we also have professional mentors. And in my early aimless 20s, I had the great good fortune to run into a guy named Wolfgang Cracker von Schwarzenfeld. So with your permission, I'd like to tell you about my old friend Wolfie. He was a real multi-hull pioneer, I'll tell you, but he's very little known for what he accomplished back in about 1955. I was working in the big schooner Janine, she was later renamed Polynesia, and we were loading stores and passengers in Miami. We had about 20 passengers. They were all from a diving club from somewhere up in the Great Lakes. And they'd come to feast their eyes on some really clear water and some real tropical coral bottom. And to augment my next-to-nothing paycheck, I was given the beer concession by Captain Mike Burke. So the beer truck was on the dock and the cases were sliding down the conveyor belt. When I saw this contraption coming across the harbor, and it took up against the wharf right behind us. It was a boat, all right. It had a mast and sails, but it also had two hulls. It was the goofiest-looking thing I'd ever seen. Actually, rather offensive to the eyes of this beholder coming from my traditional Eurocentric nautical background. And I was busy trying to get the beer on board, get it all in someplace cold. Actually, this vessel had a walk-in deep freeze, so I used to freeze most of the beer and then bring it out and throw it in a deck locker along with warm beer and let the frozen stuff cool off the warm stuff. And, oh boy, I sold a lot of beer. But this tall, skinny guy got off of the weird boat and came over to us, and I don't know who he spoke to, but anyway, he was taken to the captain. But I later learned that he'd been invited aboard for the trip because he was a photographer and the captain needed some pictures for a brochure. Well, the next thing I knew, we were underway and this guy had joined our crew, and I found myself in line with him on the halyard hoisting sail. We had motored out past the Rickenbacker Causeway and were into the open sea and trying to hoist that giant mainsail. And it required the whole crew and a bunch of passengers to haul that baby up 176 feet. I didn't really speak with this guy, but I could see he was a willing worker. And that evening, as the ship was underway in light airs, headed for Bimini, I had a chance to sit and talk with this guy over dinner a little bit. His German accent was pretty thick, but I did get the picture that he had crossed the Atlantic in that boat. And furthermore, it was the only boat that he had ever sailed. And that night we had a chance to share a watch together, and we soon became fast friends. Now, also in the crew was a young woman, one Jeannie Miller, who really took a shine to Wolfgang, and vice versa. And the next thing I knew, we were a triumvirate. We became quite a team working together, shepherding the divers around, and trying to help with serving food and taking care of their many needs. Jeannie was good at it. And 10 days later, she too was invited to join the crew. And we carried diving parties in a triangle from Miami to Nassau, the other Bahamas, over to Cuba, to Havana, and back to Miami. We boiled down to 5 black Bahamians, then myself, Wolfie, Jeannie, and the captain. And well, our itinerary kept changing because we got ran out of Miami by the Coast Guard for safety violations. It would have been prohibitively expensive for us to upgrade the ship in order to satisfy U.S. Coast Guard requirements. So we moved our base to Nassau, Bahamas, and we had to fly our passengers over from Miami. And that worked for a while until, for some reason, we also got ran out of Nassau, but eventually settled in Havana, operating 2 10-day trips per month with a 5-day layover between each trip in Havana. There was a lot of hard work to do, but we also had some fun. And of course, I bumped into a girlfriend, and it really opened up the country for me. I began to learn to speak a little Spanish. And it's a long story, kind of sad, but we eventually the three of us took berths in another boat. Wolfgang had overheard a conversation in German on the dock and introduced himself and realized that a yacht broker, who also spoke German, had just sold a boat to one Hans Hoffmann. It was a nice steel catch of about 51 feet, and we lived on board for about 2 months in a shipyard in Miami while the thing was sandblasted and upgraded. If you can imagine living aboard a steel boat that was being sandblasted, oh man. But at length we sailed away from Miami and over to Havana again. The boat's owner was a German-Colombian, actually the Cessna aircraft distributor for Colombia. So our destination was South America. And on the way down through the Western Caribbean, we had to traverse that long channel between those two reefs that I spoke of, Abre Ojos and Quitasueño. We were able to get a good position at Swan Island, and then continued on down through that channel with an anxious night. And in the dawn watch, the owner and I had the watch together, and just as soon as it began to get light enough, he asked me to go up the mast and see if I could see Old Providence Island. Well, we had ratlines up as far as the first spreader, but only on the starboard side, and that happened to be the downwind side. I went up those ratlines hanging out over the water backwards. There was enough heeling on the vessel so that by the time I reached the first spreader, I was still suspended way out over the water. But I was able to wriggle around to the upwind side, sit on the upper spreader and hang on, and look around a little bit. And oh my, what a sight it was. Looking down on the boat, it seemed to be a model of itself. Hans Hoffmann, the owner, was in the cockpit. He looked like a puppet. And coming out from behind the boat was what seemed to be the whitest white in the world of the water in her wake. But it was still dark enough so that everything else around the boat was dead black. She seemed to be suspended in the night, but with this wake coming out from behind. And the more I looked at the wake, the more I realized that there was this faint blue-green contrail underneath it that was coming out behind the ship. It was made of dinoflagellates, those incredible creatures, you know, phosphorescence it's called, that whenever you agitate the water, it lights them up like lightning bugs, but millions of them forming an endless contrail of this blue-white light coming out from behind the boat. It was really a beautiful sight. I had to hang on tight. The boat was pitching a bit, and when it pitched head down, of course it would hurl the masts and sails forward through the wind. And at that point there was a great howl, and the leading edge of the sails would break and flog a bit, and the leech of the jib would drum. And the acoustics up there were wonderful. I was sort of stuck in a centroid of sound, the sound of the ship moving through the waves, plus all of this going on up in the rigging. I felt like I was inside of a great wind engine. When the boat would pitch bow up, of course it would scoop the sails back against the wind where they were indeed over-trimmed, and everything would become quite silent all except for the wake, which seemed to kind of echo up through the vault of all the sails. Well, pretty soon I remembered what I was up there for, and I started to gaze off around the horizon. Still couldn't see much. There was a lot of haze around, and just the faintest glint of pink starting to show up in the east. So I just hung on for a while there, and marveled at the light working its way through the various strata from cloud to surface haze. Looking downwind and to the west, it was still night over there, definitely night's territory. But looking upwind and into the light, you could see for sure that the day was rising up. And you know, in the tropics, there's a distinct difference between night and day. It happens very rapidly. There's almost a boundary between them. And that demarcation between day rise and night set seems to come whirling through, of course, at the speed at which the Earth is rotating, which at the equator is something just over 1,000 miles an hour. So, whew, all of a sudden it was daylight, and I was looking down over the ocean. There were, you know, big chunks of purple and pink and beautiful blue in the sky, and this ocean, it was just starting to show its cobalt, but if I looked downwind, it was still black. and it was really beautiful over there to the southeast where I was looking for this island. Layers of you know, strata in the clouds, all smooth and soft horizontally, but in one place it looked like that layer of color was being punctured by something from beneath. And it turned out to be that thing they call Split Hill, an old volcanic cone on Old Providence Island. This tower of rock is split right down the middle and laying partly open, and I could barely see that way down over the horizon. It was the most beautiful sight, my first tropical island sighted in the dawn.
Well, along about late morning, we put in there, managed to pick our way through the reef and past Morgan Head. Yeah, there's a little island at the harbor entrance that has an outcropping on one end that's been naturally sculpted to look like a human head. It looks like a pirate staring out to sea. They call it Morgan Head. And Morgan, Captain Pirate Morgan, used this harbor for his lair during the days of the Spanish Main. Well, the owner, Hans Hoffman, went ashore and was able to contact by radio his business in Colombia and decided he had to go back for business reasons right away. There was indeed a little airstrip on this island, so they sent a plane, picked him up, took him back to Colombia, and left me and Wolfie and Jeannie on the boat by ourselves in this paradise. Of course, we were left with a work list, and we tore into it, did a lot to the boat while we waited. I can't remember how long for Hoffman to come back. But I do remember, indelibly, something that happened one evening when we were finishing dinner there in the saloon anchored out at Old Providence Island. Jeannie and I were talking about what a deal it was for us to find ourselves with this beautiful boat in this beautiful location. Interesting people ashore, the islanders were open to us. By now, Wolfie and I both had long beards and long blonde hair, all of it very brightly bleached to an almost yellow in the sun. Both of us tall, skinny guys, deeply tanned. The islanders called us Las Piratas, the pirates, and Jeannie was dark-haired, very statuesque, attractive, strong, vital young woman. They called her La Magnifica. So we came to know a few people ashore, and Jeannie had been a married commercial artist in Miami, and she was quite taken with the looks of the buildings at night. These were board shacks that these people lived in there at that time on Old Providence, and no electricity on the island, so lamplight was used inside the domiciles, and when walking through town, looking at the buildings, their internal lamplights would shine out through cracks in the structure, and it made them look like, Jeannie said, look like woodcuts lighted from within. Now, on board, we had a diesel generator, but the thing made so darn much noise we hardly ever used it. So one night after dinner on board, we were sitting around the lamplight, and Wolfie was sketching on something. He was always sketching on something. And Jeannie and I were talking about what a deal it was for us to be on this beautiful boat in this beautiful location. But she was saying what a shame it was that the boat didn't belong to us. She said what we really were was nothing more than floating domestics for the owner of this boat, and even though he was a pretty good guy, she felt that what we really needed was a boat of our own. And right then, Wolf turned his sketch pad around and aimed over to me, and he said, "The only trouble with my boat was it needs another boat in between." Well, I didn't know what he was talking about. I had seen his boat. It was extremely crude, made out of welded steel, a pipe framework with very thin metal welded over the framework, and a spidery bridge made of scrap pipes that join the hulls together. Actually, a very busy truss work to join the hulls of this catamaran together. There was no superstructure, just a flat deck that was covered with wooden slats. And his cockpit was nothing but a big shipping crate lashed down to the deck with some cushions in it. There were hatches into the hulls where I assumed there was some accommodation, but it must have been like living in a tank. And I just could not imagine his crossing the ocean in this thing. I didn't really believe it, you know. But here he was showing me this sketch that had three such hulls, and he, in his German accent, mumbled a very guttural word that sounded something like, trimarans. It was the first time I had heard the term. I think Wolfie was coining it on the spot, although now I know that the term was probably used as early as the 1940s by Viktor Chechet. I've told you about him, the crazy Russian artist who developed the first modern trimarans on Long Island in the mid-1940s. Contemporary with Woody Brown. But anyway, I didn't know what to make of this sketch, you know. Now, all of this was going on in the mid-1950s. It had only been about 10 years since the end of World War II. And Wolfie seemed to be reluctant to talk about himself, and so I was reluctant to ask him about himself. But when he showed me this sketch, I couldn't help but back up and say, hey, wait a minute, man. How come it was that you learned about boats anyway and crossed the Atlantic in your own vessel? Well, Jeannie had apparently heard some of this story before, and she encouraged him now. She said, come now, Wolfie, you must tell Jim about why it was you built your own boat and sailed to America. So he looked across the table at me with real sadness in his eyes. He and I were both tall, but he was even skinnier than I was, and I had noticed that his body showed the signs of rickets, which I thought of suspected might have resulted from undernourishment during the war. So anyway, he started in. And if you, patient listener, can contend with my lousy singing, you may also be able to contend with my attempt at his accent at times. He said, when I was little, we lived in Bavaria. My family was rich. We had land and a big house. I was youngest of 10 childs. When the Nazis come, they takes my whole family, except my mother and one brother. They takes our land and our house. So I grow up in München, that's Munich, all through the war, with all the bombs and the burn and the kill. But I was young, all seemed normal to me. And when the war stop, I go to school at the university, studying philosophy. I learn French, I read a book in French about the war. And all at once I realize that most people thinks of me the same as I thinks of Hitler. Well, at that point he put his head down on the table with his face in his hands, and I saw a little quaking that ended up with the very slightest sound of something like, ah. So Jeannie snuggled him and tried to comfort and said, nobody could think of you like that. Come on now, it's okay. You're with friends. So he sat up, cleared his throat, and he said, Jim, I cannot live with this. I am German, but I do not want to take and fight and burn and kill. I don't care we win or lost the war. I only know I must to go away. I must to go to show other peoples what I am. Well, I'm sure he thought about it a lot and realized that in order to really travel, he needed to cross oceans. He needed also a place to live. He did not want to throw himself upon the hospitality of others. He needed to cover great distances at very low cost. And a boat was the obvious answer, but I asked him, okay, but how come you ended up with that thing of yours? That catamaran thing. And he said, I spent weeks in museums studying boat and studying ocean. I never see ocean in my life. And I studying Polynesians, incredible sea peoples. And I think if they can do that with catamarans, I can do that with catamarans. So here was this guy, he felt he just had to get away and to other people and show them that he was not like Hitler. He had never seen the sea in his life, but he went down to Rotterdam, Holland. All through his youth, he had been working in restaurants. He knew something of the restaurant business, which would stand him in good stead later. But for now, he went and got a job with an old machinist who had a shop somewhere along the Rhine. Wolfie made friends with the guy, told him what he wanted to do. Apparently the guy had also been a dreamer in his youth, had never sailed to the South Seas. But here was a chance to help this kid. And in the yard at his machine shop, he had a bunch of scrap metal left over from the war, and that became the material of choice for Wolf to build his boat. It only took a year. He named his boat Gerumpel, which he explained later meant either confusion or garbage. That's what it was made of. He worked and planned and saved and finally was ready to go someplace. He sailed down to the mouth of the Rhine, and because marine traffic is carefully controlled, he had to tell the harbor master that he was headed for England. And the harbor master took one look at his boat and refused to give him clearance out of the country. At that point, Wolf came down with something. He got sick, and he had to sweat out quite a protracted illness on board. And in the meantime, the harbor officials forgot about him. And so one night, by way of a side canal, he went creeping out into the English Channel, having never seen the ocean in his life. And now his story became almost telegraphic. He did not have charts, but he did have maps. And of course he had a compass, but he said, "Oh, Jim, I was so sick seas, I could not move. And the next night I hear waves break on rocks. Can see nothing, so drops anchor." Well, apparently the anchor grabbed the bottom. Wolfie was just absolutely washed out from seasickness. So he went down and crawled into his bunk, and he awoke in the morning with some knocking on the hull. He climbed out, looked down, and he saw several people standing around his boat, and the boat was perched on the top of a pile of rocks at low tide. So it was that Wolf learned about tides. He stayed in England briefly, worked in a restaurant, sailed his boat, got things straightened out, and took off, went out into the North Atlantic, found himself in a great storm, got totally lost, totally sick again. The weather cleared up, he drifted around for a while, then along came another storm, 3 days of storm. And he, after all that, he said, "After that, I was in Rabat, North Africa." Well, I don't really know how he got there. Oh, yeah, he told me somewhere in the English Channel he actually had a collision. He was run over by a commercial ship of some kind. He never saw the thing. It slammed into his hull, knocked him out. He came to with water pouring in. There was indeed a rent in his hull, and he was able to take a sweater and smear it up with grease and stick it in this crack and seal off the leak. I later wore the sweater. Yeah, that's right. Then came the second storm, and after that, I was in Rabat, North Africa. I mean, really? Well, he got himself a job in a restaurant and met a newspaper reporter who became fascinated with his story. He wrote it up and published it. Then Wolf was contacted by a German television station. They sent him a bunch of fancy camera equipment, gave him some money, told him to sail to America, and when he got there, they'd fly him back and he could put on a show on their television station. Well, with this good news, Wolfie was contacted by his mother, who explained that his brother, one older brother, had been released from a Russian prison camp and wanted to go to America with Wolfie. So in the meantime, Wolf had sailed out to the Canary Islands, and there he waited for his brother to join him. He said, "Come, yes, please come to America with me, but you must bring an outboard motor." So his brother showed up in the Canaries with an antique outboard motor, still wearing his Russian prison camp clothing, which included a heavy quilted cotton jacket, which I also later wore. And the two of them pulled a neat 30-day passage to Barbados in the West Indies. Now, this was one of the first crossings in a catamaran. As far as I can tell, the only other cat at the time that had crossed the North Atlantic was Eric de Bishop. This was just before James Warham made his first passage. So Wolfgang Crocker von Schwarzenfeld and his brother, Heinz, are real multi-hull pioneers. Well, Wolf went on with his story, wrapped it up pretty fast. He said he sailed up through the islands, really loved the Grenadines, finally came to Miami, got a job on Janine where I was working, bumped into Jeannie, and finished his story by, hugging and smiling at her and saying, "And then I meet it you." All of a sudden, we heard music. I guess Jeannie noticed that there was some music from outside someplace. So she stuck her head up on deck and looked around, and she said, "Hey, look at this." So we all came up into the cockpit. It took our eyes a minute or two to get used to the beautiful moonlit night. And looking out toward the moon, it was quite a sight. There was this avenue of sparkling wavelets, you know, in the path of the moon reflecting on the water. And of course, this avenue of almost flashbulb popping brightness gets wider as it approaches the observer. And coming from somewhere around the harbor, there was, you know, the sound of music, a drum beat and maybe a guitar, people singing. We couldn't see where it was coming from. Seemed to be coming from all over. And pretty soon we saw, coming onto this avenue of moon glitter, a little sailing smack. It was silhouetted against the glare of the moonlight. I remember the light coming through the sail, which appeared to be made of many different weights of cloth, literally made of patches. And we could see figures on board, all in silhouette. They were swaying with the beat. And I'll be darned, I saw what looked like a very straight glint, a reflection of moonlight off of a bottle being raised. Well, we watched this for just a moment, and finally Jeannie got excited and said, "Let's invite them over." So Wolf reached inside the hatch to the switch panel and flashed the navigation lights on the boat. And sure enough, pretty soon, here they came. I hopped down below to find our bottle of rum. It took me longer to find it than I thought. By the time I got up there, this smack had pulled up alongside of La Brisa. They were passing up the instruments, and the beat never quit. They were hand clapping when the drum was not being played, and they were singing when the guitar was not being played, and the song never stopped as four or five people came up on board and started dancing around on the deck with us. I took the cork out of our bottle and threw it overboard and passed it around. Of course, the guys all wanted to dance with Jeannie. She obliged. There was a young woman aboard who said her name was Evelyn. She was very nice to me. She said, "Which pirata you be?" Well, I didn't know what she meant, and she finally said, "What be your name, sweet honey?" I said my name was Jim, and she said, "I be Evelyn." We were kind of frugging in the cockpit, and I asked her if they often go out sailing and singing on a moonlit night, and she said, "Oh, yes, we all time moon sing when de weather nice." And she spun around there, sort of giving me a chance to look her over, and she said, "Mr. Jimsy boy, you must come along moon sing with me sometime. But tonight that little boat be full up and leaking bad." And it was, too. They had to keep somebody aboard to bail continually all the time. But even the bailer could participate. They would scoop and then dump their bilge water in time with the beat. It made this wonderful sound like cymbals teased with a wire brush, you know. Well, they didn't stay long. I think they were worried about the boat going down. It had ballast stones in the bilge, you know. When the water got up over the stones, it was time to do something. So they left, still singing. They held the song, held the beat. They sailed away singing the same song they were singing when they first came. I'll never forget it. It went something like, "Way up, Susiana. Providence is the place where I belongs in, round the Bay of Providence," over and over and over again. Incidentally, a few years later, I was living
well,
on
the three
my
of us went on
there in
Sausalito,
right across sailing the slough adventures
the
together,
where the Kingston Trio lived.
Fodder
and
for
I'll be
another
caper
cast,
singing something like
that. But jumping ahead now, when I found myself in Sausalito, and I bump it into Joanna, of course, I told her about Wolfie. And about 30 years later, Joanna was able to tell Wolfie. Yes, the first night that Jim and I had a chance to sit down and really talk with each other, he told me about you. Well, Wolfgang had a tremendous influence on my life, of course. He convinced me that I could design and build and sail, and if he could, I could, you know. Well, so much for what mentors could do for you in your life, or do to you in life. It seems to me that after Wolfie, my life was ruined, man. I was good for nothing but boats. Now, by the time this is posted in early March 2017, I'll be off on a trip. I'm going to look for field interviews so that I can share them with you folks. So this has been a while I'm away story, and we're going to have another one like it next week. These are two of my favorites. I've told them before. I'm sure some of you have heard them. But when I get back in a couple of weeks from now, I hope I have some fresh material for us to caper with. This trip is very loosely scheduled. I have no idea how it's going to come out. I may miss a week. I hope not. So until it comes around again on the guitar, fair winds.